Welcome, everybody, and we're delighted to be here at JLF. This is also going to be part of a radio series that we do on a monthly basis, a radio book club that we have, a collaboration between KGNU Radio in Boulder and the Boulder Bookstore. So you can tune in on Thursday, September 28th at 9 a.m. and hear this as a radio program. And it's also going to be available as a podcast. So as we get that out of the way, we are delighted to have Akhil Sharma join us. Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore curates our book club and he selects the authors every month. And I always start by asking, why this particular book?
Well, I was very excited when I saw that Akhil had a book of short stories coming out. I've read a few of his short stories in The New Yorker, always enjoyed them, thought it was a very interesting voice that was entertained me, taught me something. I just loved reading his work. And so when I saw there was a book of short stories out, I was very excited to try to get him onto the show. And then when it coincided with Jaipur, I thought this would be a perfect event.
So we'll jump right in on Akhil Sharma, A Life of Adventure and Delight. It is a collection of short stories. There's a story that has the title of the book, is the title of the story, and it seems like it's anything but delight. In fact, there is a lot of dysfunction with the relationships in this. There's a lot of misery that a lot of the characters are going through. And so what was the theme you were trying to explore through these stories? Was there a connectivity that you wanted to express?
I'm not sure. I mean, I wrote these stories over 20 years, and the thing that strikes me is how similar the stories are. You know, the same stuff that I worried about when I was 19 is the same stuff that I worry about now. I might be a slightly better writer, but it, you know, I don't have any more answers than I did when I was 19. And that takes me aback. In some ways, I do have to say that, you know, when we say a life of adventure and delight, it's ironic to some extent, you know, because the guy is a nut, this person who's in it. But, you know, there are people who love their misery. You know, there are people who go into a ditch and begin decorating their ditch. And this guy might be one of them.
Well, it starts with him being arrested for soliciting a prostitute. And then it seems like he turns things around and he's going to have a meaningful relationship, but that he can't quite work that out either. And that's a theme that runs through the book. It's either the relationship's going awry, either it's an arranged marriage that's not working, or even people who are able to find their own relationship seem to find the wrong relationships. And that seems like a theme you wanted to hit several times.
I grew up in a family where there was a lot of drama. And I grew up in a family where I, as a child, was very lonely. And so I was always looking to make friendships or have relationships. I remember as a child, this relative visited. And I was so unhappy that during the week he was there, all I did was follow him around back and forth, you know? And so for me, these relationships are the most important thing. But the reality is that no relationship will rescue you from your own deep unhappiness. That you sort of have to do on your own. And many of these characters are looking for relationships to act as a bridge into a different life the people that they form relationships are oftentimes not appropriate. But two, the relationship is not going to lead you anywhere because you're always, wherever you go, there you are.
Yeah, I mean, and these people are often trying to change their lives, not just through relationships, but the book is about split between stories that take place in India and stories that take place in America involving Indians that have emigrated to America, come to America. And yet, in American society, they also struggle very much. They can't quite find themselves. They can't quite fit into the society in a way that maybe they expected when they left. I'm not quite sure how to put it, but it hasn't quite worked out, it seems like.
I mean, I look at Americans, right? Americans who were born in America, Caucasians. And they don't feel like they fit in. You know, and so the sense of being out of place is universal. With these Indian characters, these Indian immigrants, we oftentimes mistake their life, the fact that they're immigrants, as sort of explanatory. We think we focus on that, but these people would have the same unhappiness elsewhere. So, for example, in the story The Well, in the first couple of drafts, I had it began with him immigrating to America, with the family immigrating to America, and then I removed that section because I just felt then it would become another immigration story, and so the entire story occurs in America, because I wanted to point out that this is just what it means to be a human being. You know, I often say that in India we have arranged marriages, and the hope, the real hope, is that these two people will begin to love each other and respect each other. In America, you begin with love, and you oftentimes end up in arranged marriages.
Well, you know what I thought, when you talk about The Well, one of the most interesting, that story's a little different in some ways than the rest, in that he finds the woman that he loves. You know, he comes up with somebody he loves, it's not arranged. But then when he wants to marry her and she is hesitant or doesn't want to marry him, he calls on his mother to come help him, as, you know, like you maybe would, seems like in a more traditional society would happen perhaps. So it's kind of this interesting mixture, but I thought that was a little different, that he had seemed to be going towards this love match, but then when push came to shove, he went back to tradition.
I mean, I think that moment when he asks his mom to come with him, it's such a trying situation that the bringing his mother along is a gesture, is a way to show that he is approaching it with the seriousness that the moment deserves. And the fact that, I think that that's the motivation behind it, to show that he is serious, he's committed, it's not mere words.
Mm-hmm. There is one story where there's an elderly Indian gentleman who lives in the US, and it seems that his wife has left him, and his daughter, who's grown up, has also left. And he engages in a relationship, or at least tries to have a relationship, with an American neighbor. And he seems so bereft of the tools to have a genuine relationship, he turns to women's magazines, Cosmopolitan and Mademoiselle. This is what a woman wants in a relationship. And it nearly uses them as a handbook to have interactions with this woman.
But the interesting thing about that is that it actually does work.
I got some hints for my wife, you know.
It's funny, like the most obvious things we need somebody to tell us, right? Like we need somebody to say, hey, in a relationship, tell the truth all the time. You know, in a relationship, tell people what you're afraid of, tell them what makes you happy. You know, whereas the default when you're very scared, as this person is to just become whatever the other person needs so they won't leave you. That's sort of, for him, that's a big thing. And that also in that relationship, the relationship has problems, but the fact that he becomes a better human being through trying to be a better person with this woman, you know, Proust said that most men become men through the women they love.
Yeah. I mean, in that story, he's an interesting character because he's been left. You know, a lot of these characters are eternally trapped in a relationship, it seems like. But his wife left, which is, in a weird way, freed him. He doesn't feel like he's freed until he starts having a relationship with his neighbor. But he doesn't drink at all, and so many of these characters drink. And he said a line that I thought was very interesting, that he felt like to drink was to be American, and he wasn't quite Americanized. But drinking goes across all different cultures in these stories. And it seems like a major coping mechanism for many of these characters is to rely on alcohol.
Many of these characters, alcohol means different things in different situations. So, for example, in one of the stories, there's in a story called "The Heart Is Such a Heavy Thing," there's a guy who gets very drunk, but partially he gets very drunk because alcohol is expensive, and so he wants to consume as much of it as possible. Like, it isn't that he really wants the booze, but hey, it's free. Let me get drunk. And so the motivation there is slightly different from what it would be elsewhere. But yes, certainly.
There's one very stark story where alcoholism is right there. There's a mother. This is the Indian family in the US, and she just starts drinking more and more, and the child notices it when she stops drinking just at parties and then at dinner, but then it gets earlier in the day. And then there's one time where she just almost cheerfully seems to say, I'm going to spend a weekend in bed just getting drunk, and gets all her provisions, water, lots of wine, a bucket for whatever bodily functions might ensue. And she almost seems happy with that situation, yet it starts to spiral into this just awful series of events for her and her family. And that seemed the extreme end of the spectrum of the drinking.
You know, in that story, it originally began with the father being the drunk. But then I thought, hey, you know, there are too many stories about the man being a drunk. Let's see if we can write a story about a woman being a drunk. At least it'd be interesting. Oftentimes as a writer, you're always thinking, what have you not seen before? So it'll be interesting.
She commits herself wholeheartedly to this endeavor. I mean, essentially drinks herself to death, although that's not exactly what kills her.
It's funny, like alcoholics, you meet them and you think, what are you doing? Like, and for them, this is the greatest thing in the world, to be drunk out of their mind all the time. Whereas I think for most human beings, you know, you get drunk and it becomes kind of boring.
You know, having the woman be the person who gets drunk allowed to explore something else in that story, and how the family ultimately deals with her, and what woman's rights are, woman's life is like sometimes in India when she has problems or struggles. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit and that aspect of the story.
You know, I'm Indian. I'm of Indian origin, and I love India. You know, my relatives are there, and it matters very much to me that things in India are okay. But there's an enormous, enormous misogyny in India. Like, it's really tough to be a woman in India. You know, whatever we might say, you know, that, oh, in the West, it's tough being a woman. In India, it's a different intensity. So I met a guy in India who's an alcoholic. He's a member of AA. And I was asking him if there are women who are alcoholics in AA in India. And he said, oh, no, we kill them all. And I really was taken aback. And I said, what do you mean? He said, yeah, mostly what happens is that the family kills them. And so the story became about that, or that became the end of the story.
There were other hints of misogyny in Indian society in another book. I think it was The Well, where somebody, and it's just really a sentence where I think the female cousins had been forced to have abortions because they were carrying female.
Yeah, they're first
fetuses.
Like, I've had that happen with cousins of mine. It always struck me as very sad. You know, the family would want the first child to be a son, and so would force my cousins to get abortions. And you know, I love India, and it's awful to say these things about a country you love and a culture you love. You know, on the other hand, you know, it's also a great country. It's a tremendous country, and I adore it. But part of love is sort of seeing somebody clearly. You know, if you can't see somebody clearly, it isn't actual love.
Well, maybe this is a good segue into having you read a little bit, because what we're talking about is such heavy topics. You know, we're talking about people really suffering and sometimes in misery, but that's not how you feel when you read these books. His prose is buoyant, it's beautiful. And so we're going to have him read a section about love, about at least trying to fall in love. And this comes from the story, The Well. And I'll hand it over to you.
Then, too, I often thought I was in love. This is when he's in high school, I think junior high and high school. Then, too, I often thought I was in love. First, there was a girl named Joanne who was very skinny and had square blonde hair and who worked at a dry cleaner. In high school, there was a pudgy girl with pasty skin named Kathy. Both were quiet and listened intently in class. Both were good at math and hoped to be engineers. Although I spoke to them only a few times, in each case I thought about the girl all day and dreamt of her at night. I would fantasize about living happily together and being good. When I married, I thought, I will give my wife a single flower every day. In my fantasy, we were always married. Although this idea was vague and to me represented mainly by our living in a house that had a dining table. I went to Rutgers for college. I was fat. I didn't know much about women. My father once told me, Pavan, don't be proud. Marry someone taller than you. My mother laughed with malice. The first well that gives this boy water, he will build his house next to.
You talk there, the character, and there's a reference to size and fat, and that's in quite a few of the stories. You talk about the weight or the size of different people. I mean, is that kind of body image, the pressure on women and men, is it the same in India as it is here in the US?
You know, in some ways, I mentioned fat because in some places in India, right, in certain socioeconomic groups, to be fat is fantastic.
And there's one character who aspires to it, and he thinks this is going to be a mark of success.
Like, it's to be fat, like, I know that, you know, that I've been complimented by somebody saying, oh, you come from a family that eats, you know, and so it doesn't, being your body shape is present and meaningful, but what that meaning is varies quite a bit. So it might mean something really fantastic, that you're prosperous, that you're part of the elite. It might also mean that you're corrupt, because the way you get all the money to buy all these calories is through corruption. It might mean that you're just a fat guy, you know? But it signals in a much clearer, it is more meaningful, I think, in India to be fat than it is here. Like, if you meet a fat child in India, you can almost always say, oh, this child must be from a particular socioeconomic group.
Is that changing with more Western media being, you know, broadcast and people being exposed to other ways of thinking?
Is it changing? You know, when we talk about India, oftentimes what we're talking about is that 2% of the population that has some exposure to English, right? So for 98% of the country, the change has not happened that much. You know, so we have, you know, the Times of India or any of the big English language newspapers, they have massive circulations, you know, millions and millions of people. But they're nothing compared to the Hindi or regional language newspapers, which are 30 million, a circulation of 30 million or 40 million. And so to comment as to what is the effect of Western media images on India, it has some impact, but not as much as one would think.
I found it interesting, talking about media and big overarching things here, I found it interesting how localized religion was, that there's a temple on the street, or there's a little place where you pray right on your own lane. That came in on several stories too, that there was a real localized sense of religion rather than necessarily a big overarching thing.
Yeah, you don't have to go far to find a temple. And like in the alleyway where my mother's family lives, you have a temple, like a formal temple in the lane, and then there'll be a little thing to pray at before you exit the lane. You know, so that when you leave, if you've forgotten to go into the temple, you can do a quick prayer. And it's localized not merely in that sense of temples or places to pray, but it's localized in the way that belief is manifested. So for example, you will, in Delhi, in the old fort, there's a particular wall where Muslims will come and pray, and they'll pour milk on this wall the same way that Hindus might, and they'll come and pray if they want children, and then Hindus now go and pray there as well, and so it's localized not just in that, oh, there's these places near you, but it's localized in terms of what are the rituals that follow. So for example, there's a tree in a village where you'll go and drive a nail into it and tie a thread. you know, to ask for a wish. And so it's very particular.
It seems like it borders sometimes on what we would call superstition.
Well, I mean, the difference between Christianity and sort of what you would consider Indian superstition is the fact that Christianity has a longer period of being a text-based religion, and so it is more consistent, whereas Hinduism became a text-based religion relatively late. It was much more of an oral religion, and so there's much greater variety in it. But if you were going to call it, I don't know, I mean, is it superstition? Is it religion? Is it merely faith? I don't know. I mean, those are fine distinctions.
Well, in one of the stories, when the character is supposed to be praying for his brother's health, he ends up wanting to pray to Superman. You know, as one of the Americanized, I thought that was kind of a brilliant thing, that he didn't want his mother to find that out, you know, but he was really sort of praying to Superman.
In another draft, he was praying to the Marlboro Man. You know, it's funny, like all these things that you, these changes that you make in your stories, and you go back and think, oh, should it have been the Marlboro Man? That's why it's good to never revisit stories. You know, you write it and you put it behind you.
Well, that's interesting, because I wanted to ask you, Your Family Life was your previous novel that came out maybe 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a brilliant novel. And the story I'm referring to is actually the same characters, and it's somewhat of an excerpt of that, but it's told in the third person, where family life is told in the first person. I wonder if you could address the difference between telling it as a novel, telling it, that story as a story, and how that came about, that you have two different ways that you're kind of telling that same story.
I wrote the short story first, and I wrote the short story in third person because if you're writing something that is tremendously painful, third person allows a certain level of distance. Whereas in first person, the I that is suffering, one, it begins to feel repetitive and a bit dull. You know, like if you meet some guy who's, you know, his wife is dying of cancer, his mother has Alzheimer's, you know, he has diabetes, at some point you begin to think, you see the person, you want to run away, right? But if you put it in third person, it's somebody else telling a story, there's a distance which is helpful. We become much more tolerant of that. The third person consumes plot at a slightly different rate than first person. So first person, for example, is, in fiction, plot is, what is at stake is always character. It is the person that is responding that is at stake. And so if it's a first person narration, the I is always responding. I feel this, I feel that. And so something is always at risk. Something is always meaningful. If you put it into third person, what is meaningful has to be more obviously meaningful. It has to be meaningful in the standard of what is objective. And so the plot gets consumed at a much faster rate than in first person.
So then, if you wrote the story first, then you decided to explore it again more fully, maybe as a novel, and you did move it into the first person. Why did you just make that decision? And
I made that decision because I didn't have as much plot in the novel, and so to allow the absence of plot to manage the absence of plot, I put it into first person. In the story, You are happy. Originally, the first four or five drafts were in first person, but it wasn't working because there's a certain level of alienation that is needed for that story to work. And it doesn't seem natural in first person, so I switched it to third person, which only took like an hour and a half. And then suddenly the story was working.
That's the story where the woman climbs into bed with
yes,
all the alcohol.
Yes, and begins drinking, yeah.
You spoke at the beginning of the forum about your feeling of loneliness when you were a child and the kind of self-awareness, I suppose, you had there. I was struck by how little self-awareness many of the characters had, or maybe they just didn't want to go, you know, dip a toe in that water because there was so much complexity of the emotions underneath this kind of veneer, and it's a beautifully written narrative, but you can sense all of this complex emotions that are behind all of that.
I would argue slightly differently. That is, that they have self-awareness. They have very little self-control. You know, like the in Cosmopolitan, in the first story, the narrator, this old guy who's hooked up with his neighbor, and keeps hoping that she won't leave him. At one point, he thinks, you know, I'll bring a bottle of wine, and maybe she'll get drunk, and we can fool around. You know, so he has self-awareness. What he doesn't seem to process is that's not a healthy way to do things. You know, so it isn't that they're not aware, they just cannot think through to the next thing, which is there is a healthy way to do things and an unhealthy way to do things. And they're so desperate, all of them, that they're willing to take whatever comes their way, whether healthy or unhealthy.
And there's a lot of unhealthy relationships in it, it seems.
There's a lot of suffering, you know, but there's a lot of suffering everywhere.
Yeah. Do you think that desperation is just part of who we are as humans, no matter what our culture is, whoever you are, it's that the certain desperation, suffering is going to find you?
We are all going to suffer, right? We're all going to get old. Our loved ones are all going to get old. We're going to be regularly overwhelmed. We're going to feel confused. We're going to feel bad. You know, we're going to feel angry when our loved ones are sick and we just don't, our compassion runs out. And that's going to happen to every one of us. The suffering of these characters maybe is, I don't know if it is greater, right? I don't know if it's greater. I think they just have fewer resources.
Mm-hmm. How many autobiographical elements are in the stories? How much did you draw from your own personal experience or your family's experience?
I mean, my emotions are the same, right? You know, so the emotions are, I was lonely, and so it's easy for me to inhabit the world of lonely people. Or I had an uncle who said to me, who loved me, and said, Akhil, don't be proud, marry someone taller than you. And so these things, I include all of them wherever I can into my life or wherever it's useful. But, you know, the difference between autobiography and these stories is I'm the guy who wrote them. You know, so I can shape the material, I'm aware of the material, and, you know, I lead a very privileged life. So this is not, you know, and if you're privileged, you're not as desperate. There's a story in here called We Didn't Like Him. And that's a story I wrote from the point of view of somebody rich. By that I mean that, you know, I'm a well-off guy, right? And so I can approach things with this idea that mostly things don't matter. You know, they're problems, but mostly they don't matter that much to me. And so this is a story where somebody is not desperate. The people that he's interacting with might be desperate, but he is not. And he is not lonely. The people he's interacting with might be lonely because they're less. And so that I found to be a very different story.
That's one of my favorites in the book. I feel like a lot of different things are happening there. And there's a line, though, when I think about, in the stories that take place in America, these Indian families feel somewhat isolated. I mean, maybe there's some other families in their group that they are with, but they're in America and seem somewhat isolated. And there was a line early in that story, which takes place in India, that really, I thought, brought out the difference in the cultures to some extent. And he's talking about this other character, Manchu, and he says, he was my father's, sister's, husband's, sister's son. And so that basically counts. Yes, that counts as family, right? In India, where I think most people who are raised in America cannot name any of their father's, sister's, husband's, sister's, sons.
I'll tell you a detail, right, which will show you how different life in India is or was than it is in America. When I was a child, when we would school would start up again, right, and so there would be an assembly where the principal welcomed us back, and always he would name the two or three children who had died over the summer, some diphtheria or malaria, and because you know. Life, that happens, you know. People die much more in India than they die in the West. The children of middle-class people. And I remember that every one of us, all of us kids, you know, in that first week or so, we would walk and talk in our sleep, we would wet our beds. And our parents would think that this was because we were scared of going back to school. But it was really because we'd just learned that kids that we knew had died. And I remember coming to America, and when the school started, when you had the assembly, the principal didn't begin it by talking about who was dead. You know, so it's a different world.
One of the themes that seems to run across several of the stories is smell, and characters being very aware of smell and odor, particularly as it pertains to them, whether they're washing because they want to get rid of this smell, whether they're, you know, cleaning up after having a meal because they don't want the smell to linger and people to think, oh, those are those Indians with their stinky food. Was that a conscious thing? Because I noticed that throughout some of the stories.
I mean, it's a conscious thing. So, I mean, it occurs with, like, there's a woman who's talking about sort of, you know, her husband coming, and she's been apart from him for a couple of weeks, and so she bathes very carefully. And this sense of how to be appealing to somebody else, that pressure, I think everybody experiences. And with the, you know, when you are, and then the other, the food one, where there are these graduate students and they're eating their lunches, and they're very conscious of, you know, they don't want to, they want to make sure that whatever room they eat in, they're not going to feel, they're not going to leave an odor. That desire to not create any more differences than already exist. You know, to be a brown person, to have an accent already marks you as different. Why make your life any harder than it needs to be? You know, if you can be a little bit more careful, then you become a little bit more careful. But that pressure is everywhere.
That story that you mentioned there about the woman who's been away from her husband for a couple of weeks, that was an arranged marriage. Mm-hmm. And that seems to have a certain arc to it, because at some point in the relationship, she convinces herself that she's in love with him. Prior to that, it seemed like, oh, I guess I'm in love with him. And then she's all concerned that he's going to love her back. And there seemed to be an arc to the love as part of an arranged marriage. I mean, how, as a culture, does arranged marriage deal with that notion of love? Or is love not even considered when marriages are arranged?
You know, love, it's very important. I think everybody realizes that affection is very important inside a relationship. And respect is very important inside a relationship. And there is this belief, you know, that people of good faith, of good heart, when they're together, after a little while, they'll begin to feel respect and they're going to begin to feel affection. The reality, however, oftentimes is that people are mismatched. You know, it's so hard for us to live with ourselves. Imagine how hard it is to live with somebody else. And you know, in that relationship, in that story, you know, if you sing like that for me, the wife, if she had married somebody else, maybe she would have been perfectly suitable. If he had married somebody else, he would have been perfectly suitable for that woman. And it's just sort of, people get mismatched. You know, it isn't possible to say that, hey, if you're a good person, you'll necessarily be able to have a loving relationship with whoever you end up with. That's just not reality.
And at the end of that story, she has convinced herself that she is in love with her husband and she really wants him to love her back. He makes a statement about how he almost had to settle for her because he had wanted, I think he said, a woman with at least an MA. Yep. And he had to settle for her. And we don't hear from her perspective, but I think her face is just, she's just horrified by this realization that I guess she was, you know, he settled for her.
You know, we want to be not merely tolerated, but adored. And you know, the for her it, and some people need. I mean, and I think that that's for her. There's a real sense that oh, the way she needs to be cared for is not the way this person can care for her. You know, he'll always be a decent person. He'll always be loyal. You know, but he's not. She will not be special to him.
He struck me as someone who should be reading The Cosmopolitan and getting his tips on how to relate to women.
Well, he's going to be somebody who is not going to be satisfied, you know, no matter what, in a way that goes beyond culture. Here's one of my favorite lines in the book, and this is him thinking at the very end of the story, or this is him saying this. He tells this to his wife. There are so many people in the world that it's hard not to think that there are others you could love more. I mean, if that's you know, that there's people in America, there's people in every culture that if they have that way of thinking, it's going to be very hard to be satisfied in any relationship.
Yeah, I mean, the issue is not so much choices. You know, there are always more people, different people, better looking people, smarter people, richer people. The issue is not, the reason somebody is valuable is because you choose to invest in them. You know, you choose to care, you choose to be honest with them, you choose to respond to them. That's why people become valuable. It isn't innate to them.
There's also this theme of the dowries as well, because with the arranged marriage, there's the dowry. And with the arranged marriage, it seems the women, once again, are coming off the worst end of it. It's the women's family who have to come up with the expensive dowry. And if it's not satisfactory enough, there's one where a washing machine was given as part of the dowry. And they're like,
they have
give
no
us a
running
bucket
water,
of water.
Right?
We don't have running water here. How are we supposed to have a washing machine?
Except in that case, the dowry is sort of a joke, because in that story, at least, you know, they get these things. They would rather not have them. Like, you know, we have running water from 6:30 in the morning to 9, and from 5 to 9. We don't want a washing machine, you know. And, you know, the family of the bride says, look, I'm sorry, you got the washing machine now. Tough luck to you.
And she helpfully says, well, use it as a closet. You can
store stuff in it. It's not my problem anymore.
That's one of the arranged marriages you think has a chance, though. She kind of wins over the family during that. They want to reject her at first, and then she kind of wins over the family, and I think the man who's going to be her husband, who is her husband, is kind of won over by that. She has this practicalness about her that some of the other characters don't necessarily have.
And at the beginning, they see that practicalness as mental illness.
Yes, yeah. They think she's mentally
crazy.
Ill. Yes.
Then they're like, no, she's just quite forthright.
Yeah, she's just very honest.
One of the themes that kept coming up is, and I think this is true of anybody anywhere, is you want your life to be broad. You want to have options open to you. And a lot of times you use the word that the characters are feeling narrowed. You use the word narrow a few different times for how they're feeling about different things or where they live, the narrow lanes maybe. This feeling between openness and narrowness and how that can change very quickly in somebody's life.
You know, people do feel boxed in. And I think oftentimes, like, there's a character whose sister is an epileptic, and he talks about how the fact that, you know, if you have somebody in your family who's ill in a certain way, you end up hiding that because it can, you know, it might bring shame on you, it might make it harder for your relatives to get married. And so when he gets to tell somebody who, you know, what is actually true for him, he can relax a bit, he can be present. He is not being guarded all the time. When I can speak to you honestly and I can tell you these things, then I can say, oh, I'm getting to be present with you. I don't have to protect myself from you. So that's when they relax, you know, the fist unclenches.
In that story, I think, with the sister with the epilepsy, and I think the brother who's in the US, he's a grad student, I think the other character that he has disclosed this to says, well, maybe you can help their children. I mean, there's always this sense that there's a sense of obligation to help other generations, that interconnectedness across family lines.
I mean, in that story, so he's talking about his sister who has epilepsy and it was very, very hard to get her married. and they were finally able to, so she has a BA or BCom, a Bachelor in Commerce, and they're able to get her married, but to somebody who I don't think has a college degree. And he goes to work in the Middle East, and she's treated like a servant. And his girlfriend, the narrator's girlfriend, says, knows that he can't help his sister, you know, that her life is to some extent decided already. But knows also that he would like to love her, love his sister in a certain way. And so says, oh, maybe you can help her children. Here's an opportunity for you to love. You know, we're looking for opportunities to love the people we love. And the problem is that oftentimes we don't have these opportunities. You know, the situations they're in, we cannot help them with. And so we're looking around for when can we be of service to these people we adore. And so for her saying this, it isn't just obligation, but it's a way of, it's a kindness, a mercy. It's a way of saying, oh, I know this is very tough for you, but don't worry. There's a way where you'll get a chance to be good to your sister.
You know, in the story, if you sing like that for me about the woman in the arranged marriage, she's taking care of her father. Mm-hmm. And the relationship she has with her father and the relationship her sister has with her father are so different that she does take that opportunity to there is some gentleness and affection there, where with her sister and the mother, it seems like that it's too far gone or something's not possible anymore.
Or it, you know, in that, like, the younger sister is much tougher, you know, and so is much more willing to cut her losses and say, look, this guy is a nut, he'll use us, he'll betray us, he can't be relied upon, and is willing to move on and take care of herself. And the older sister, and the younger sister is also much more successful, and the older sister who is, you know, is not as successful, maybe is more sensitive, feels an obligation to take care of people. And who is the wiser person in that situation? You know, I can't tell.
You wrote these stories over, I think you said 20 years?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so were there other stories that didn't make the cut to make it into the book?
Oh, yeah, lots of stories. Okay. I mean, there are a lot of for every 6 stories I write, I publish one, you know, because they're not that good. I wrote a story about Abraham Lincoln. Truly terrible, awful story. And then there's stories that I publish which I don't think are that good.
Well, you know, I am struck that George Saunders, though, just got is the finalist for the Booker Prize with his book about Abraham Lincoln. So maybe a little rewriting and
yes, why not? Hope springs eternal.
Do you go back to some of those stories, though, and will you try to get them to a place, or do you at some point give up? That's it, I'm done.
You know, if it's broken, it's broken. There's so many things worthwhile. Why keep going back to try to fix something that's broken?
Now, one of the short stories in the book did end up as a novel. Do you see that potential for any of the other, not so much stories, but certainly the characters?
It's very hard to open up a story and turn it into a novel. You know, a story has its own form, its own logic. I mean, anything is possible, but it's probably not wise to do so because you then have to relearn certain things. You have to think about your story in a different way. It's better to just begin a fresh thing.
Are there any characters that really live on after you've closed the book on the story that you think that there's maybe a future for them somewhere else, even in a walk-on part?
Not really. I mean, I have a sense as to what will happen to these characters in their lives, but I don't see, you know, I end the story where I end them because I feel like it's sufficient.
Well, you end the title story where he's with a prostitute jumping up and down, overjoyed to be holding her breasts. And that is, you know, after this whole up and down with his relationships and being in jail and everything, to me, I love that story, and I thought that was a perfect place to end it, but I wouldn't mind seeing him show up again at some point.
I'll keep that in mind.